Senate Tax Committee to order. Members, this morning we're going to take up Senate File 2696, the department's technical bill, and then we're going to have a presentation and discussion about the tax expenditure report with Dr. Wilson. So first, Article 1, Steve Crinkle from the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Crinkle, Department of Revenue. I am going through Article 1 of the bill. This is technical changes. I'll start with Section 1, and that Section 1, if you'll go back in the body of the bill to about the third page, you'll notice that it's just a change in cross-references occasioned by Sections 7 and 8. And Sections 7 and 8 also affect Sections 9 through 13, which are also cross-references. Section 7 and 8 is a deletion, a repeal of obsolete language for a small ethanol producer credit that expires by its very terms in the statutes. Section 2 changes the date that mutual funds that pay municipal bond interest must provide statements to their investors from January 30 to January 15th. It also this conforms to a newly enacted federal due date, so it's a federal conformity issue. Section 3 is also a conformity issue. It simplifies the language of Minnesota due dates for corporations. Instead of going through a recitation of how you compute it, it simply references the federal due date. It doesn't change the dates for filing. Section 4 is another federal conformity issue, clarifies that when an estate elects to defer paying Minnesota estate tax, it pays through an installment plan, which they can do by making a corresponding federal election. It can follow the federal treatment determining the proportion of total Minnesota tax that is eligible for deferred payments. Section 5 amends the language regarding frivolous return penalties. It consistently applies the terms taxpayer. It has no retroactive effect, and it doesn't change the effect of the statute. Section 6 and 7 deal with municipal bond interest paid by mutual funds by federal statute. It cannot include the bond interest from territorial bonds, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, and Guam. Seeing whereas federal law preempts state law, this is simply a clarification that state law follows that federal law. And Section 6, in a corresponding change, clarifies how those bonds are included in the denominator of the apportionment factor. And I've already covered Section 7 and 8, and that's Article 1.
Questions, members? Article 2.
Article 2, Susan Berry from Department of Revenue. This is a sales and use tax article. Section 1 is a clarification that the combined sales tax rates of the 6.5% of the first subdivision and then the additional increased rate that was constitutionally mandated, that when you combine those two, all throughout the sales tax chapter, they shall apply. Throughout the sales tax chapter, most of the references are only to subdivision 1, which is just 6.5%. There's not an additional reference to the new increased rate. So this would clarify that the combined rate would apply throughout. It does, however, note that it does not apply to subdivision 3, of the imposition section, because that has to do with manufactured homes, and that tax is on 65% or 60% of the dealer's cost and not on the gross receipts, whereas the increased rate was only on the gross receipts. And I understand that there is going to be an amendment to that. But yeah.
Why don't we take that up, Ms. Berry? Council? Is it in our packet?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's in the packet. It's the SCS 26968-2 amendment.
Council, what does it do?
That would provide that it incorporates the provision that was in the department's bill in Section 1, but it also does provide that the constitutionally imposed sales tax increase would apply to the manufactured home sales.
That was probably our legislative intent, I would think.
Mr. Chair, I don't quite understand what the rationale would be for not imposing it on them as well, so.
Or
E2.
Ms. Goy moves the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
If you're no, motion prevails, the amendment's adopted.
Section 2 of the article. Under the current law, sellers are relieved of tax liability if the seller can provide substantiation to the commissioner of sales tax exemptions within 120 days after the date that the commissioner requests the substantiation. This law clarifies that if the seller does not provide the substantiation within that time, then the exemptions will be disallowed. Section 3 on pre-existing bids or contracts. Since the seller is only required to receive fully completed exemption certificates, this deletes the requirements that for each of the qualifying contracts or bids, the contractor must give the seller documentation of the contract or bid. Section 3, this adds the nonprofit designation that was inadvertently admitted when the sales tax chapter was recodified in the year 2000. And clarifying that the organizations that exist solely for the purpose of providing educational or social activities to young people must be nonprofit. And Section 5 takes care of an effective date of session law that incorrectly had applied to registrations made or renewed and instead should be applying to leases or rentals made or renewed. And that's the end of the article.
Mr. Berry, before we move from the sales tax article, how do we talk about our sales tax now? Do we have a general sales tax rate at 6.5 and then a 0.375 addition to that, or how do we characterize our sales tax?
We say that the state sales tax rate is the combined rate.
So it's.
Senator Shiway, does that sound?
I'm trying to figure that out. I live in Hennepin County, Chairman, so I have no clue what my sales tax rate is. I just don't know it off the top of my head.
Except that it's higher than 6.875.
I think so. Maybe Senator Pogamiller knows what it is.
Senator Pogamiller and I, we voted against that bill. Ms. Berry, thank you. Article 3.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mikhail Garber, and I'll go over Article 3. Section 1 deals with obtaining coverage from an ineligible surplus lines insurance. It's a Commerce Department provision that provides cross-reference to Chapter 297I and clarifies that a surplus lines licensee is required to pay the tax when purchasing coverage from an ineligible insurer. Sections 2 and 3 deal with underpayment of estimated tax. This is a Minnesota CARE provision, and it provides safe harbor to a new business, which is not required to make estimated payments during the first year of business. Section 4 deals with sales to non-qualified buyers. It's a cigarette tax provision and deletes an obsolete reference to selling contraband cigarettes. Section 5 deals with return due dates. It's an insurance tax provision. It deletes obsolete references to Section 297I05 and gives specific due dates for filing returns for certain taxes. Section 6 deals with return due dates and deletes obsolete references to Section 297I05. Section 6, 7, and 8 all clarify provisions dealing with forms prescribed by the commissioner, and this is consistent with other similar provisions. Again, it deletes some obsolete references. Section 9 deals with electronic payments of insurance tax. It corrects some inconsistency in the law versus the effective date and clarifies that the threshold period applies to the fiscal year. Section 10 and Section 11 deal with insurance tax and correct obsolete references to certain section and add a reference to life insurance. Section 12 is a production tax provision and corrects the reference from tax relief area to taconite assistance area. And Section 13 is a repealer. It repeals provisions dealing with due dates for filing returns, since these provisions have already been corrected under Section 5.
Thank you. Any questions on Article 3? Article 4.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lance Tarica with the Department of Revenue. I will withdraw Article 4. Article 4 mainly consists of provisions that correct and update references in the statutes. Section 1 corrects some references in the Regional Library Support Grant Requirement Statute, eliminating references to the old HACA statute and replacing them with references to the Market Value Credit Statute, and changing wording from credit reductions to credit reimbursement reductions. Section 2 adds a reference in the PSO statutes 270C so the commissioner can produce and distribute the assessor's manual without having to do that as a promulgating a rule. Section 3 corrects exemption for wind energy production taxpayers in a job zone to make sure that they have signed the business subsidy agreement. In sequence of the statutes, I think there's going to be amendment offered to a statute that would fit in sequentially next. It has to do with the statute providing a property tax credit for taxpayers who in the Northwest who've been affected by the bovine TB quarantine.
Where is that?
I'm not sure if you want to talk about the amendment at this time or you want to wait till the
end. Let's talk about it now. What Senator Scoy moves the A-10-2074.
I think Jason wants to.
Mr. Nord?
Mr. Chair, Jason Nord of the Department of Revenue. This is just there was a bit of an oversight in the original language about making sure that it was clear that the Department of Education pays the school district share of the reimbursements for the bovine TB credit. And so this just amends two different sections, one to make it clear that that is the case, and the other amending the school districts or the Department of Education statute that directs them how to pay school districts to make sure it's included in both parts of the statute. So it just it codifies what our current practice is.
On the SCOI motion to adopt 810-2074. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, Section 4 of the bill has to do with the new Rural Preserve Property Tax Program, and we are amending here the cross-compliance, I guess you might call it, the existing prohibition against also being enrolled in other programs. We are striking a reference to the 273117, which is a conservation easement valuation provision, because we don't think that's inconsistent. But we are adding a prohibition against also being enrolled in the Metro Area Agricultural Preserve Program because that literally provides the same benefit. Section 5 has to do with truth in taxation. Last year, we eliminated the requirement for meetings, but there was added a requirement that the local unit provide information on a regular meeting at which they discuss their budget, and the language made it appear that they had to have this special notice out there every time they might talk about the budget, and this clarifies. I'm sorry, I can't remember. I don't remember the number of the Senate file, but this incorporates the changes that the legislature was going to enact last year to make sure that the local unit isn't caught by these unending special notice requirements.
Didn't pass the House.
Excuse me.
They didn't pass the revisor's bill.
Section 6, 7, and 9 have to do with levy limits. Last year, as you know, there were some unallotments, and at the same time the unallotments were being discussed, we had to compute levy limits, and we had to decide how to handle the potential unallotments within the levy limits. There are several issues. The main issue has to do with this phrase about aids that are certified to be received under certain sections in the same year that the taxes are payable. excuse me. As you know, the levy limits are computed and adjusted for inflation, and then a subtraction for the aids in the coming year is made so that if the aids go down, the levy limit will go up. If the aids go up, the levy limit will go down. In the unallotment environment, that gets a little tricky. We did a couple of things. First of all, we looked at how we administered that in the past, and we had treated the amounts certified to receive as the amounts we certified, not the amounts we actually received, although there hadn't been an unallotment in the current levy limit regime. We also looked at what we took that interpretation, not like the three monkeys with, you know, our eyes and ears covered. We listened to the discussion and watched the legislative actions. In 2009, we saw that there were three, it depends how you count them, but basically there were three special levy provisions enacted to allow local units to accommodate the unallotments. There was no, as far as we know, there's no change to the subtraction in response to potential unallotments. To administratively change the subtraction would have rendered the three enactments by the legislature meaningless, and I don't think it would have solved the whole problem because it still would have left the local units without recovery of their market value credit cuts. And the final point would be that the timing was not right. In July, August, and September of 2009, when we were calculating the levy limits for pay 10, we really didn't know what the final unallotments would be. We didn't know whether Mahoman County would be exempted from the unallotments, and we didn't know whether some other city might receive a different cut. Therefore, we administrated the overall levy limits so that the special levies, kind of in sequence, the special levy to levy back for these emergency debt certificates. We clarified some superficially contradiction language there, so that special levy is intact. We modified a little bit the special levy in clause 22, having to do with how a local unit can levy for announced unallotments that they know about. And finally, we changed the subtraction in 275.71 sub 5 to explicitly state that the subtraction is not automatically changed when unallotments are pending.
It's only if they're self-insured.
Section 8has to do with the so-called confession of judgment statute for delinquent taxes. In that, there is a reference to timberland. We don't have a timberland category in the property tax classification statute anymore. I believe the new references to rural vacant land or managed forest land will encompass every property that could have been or was in the old timberland. So I don't think there'll be any changes by this. Section 10 updates the maximum and minimum aid increase-decrease provisions in the local government aid statute. Excuse me. This started in 2008. This provision was put in 2008. It has to do with what data we use to compute local government aid. Quickly, as I understand it, people would go home from the legislature with computer printouts showing what the recent enactments would change their local government aid, and then the data, we would get new population data or something by July, and people would find out that the levy limit for their jurisdictions in their district would have changed from what they thought they were enacting. This was an attempt to keep that data stable, but there were some exceptions for levy data that's used to compute these mins and maximums, and this was first enacted. This provision here was first enacted in 2008. We tried to correct it in 2009 for these two exceptions and didn't get it right then, and we believe we have it right this time. Section 11 has to do with emergency medical service districts. You could read through the summary. Two law changes were made last year, one extending it permanently and the other extending it to 2012, and this makes sure that both are extended permanently. That's everything in Section 4.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sturica, back on Section 4, the rural preserve, what is 273.117 that you're removing?
That's a provision relating to conservation easements. Hopefully everyone... Basically, what happens with a conservation easement is you dedicate some portion of your property, some undivided portion of your property, like the development rights or something like that. You donate that permanently to the government or some nonprofit, and you can get a value reduction for that. If doing that reduces the taxable value of your property, you can apply to the assessor and get a reduction. We don't think that's inconsistent with the rural preserve program, where you can enroll your land and have it valued at its basically its agricultural value. So you might have a real high recreational value to your property. You donate this easement, and that reduces it a little bit. But the value might still be above what an ag value would be, and so you could still enroll in the rural preserve program and get that second benefit. We don't see that as being inconsistent.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Borgemeyer.
It looks, I'm looking at Section 6, 7, and 9, and 6 and 9 appear to be specific to a type of levy, special levy. 7 may also be, but the language is much more complex, so I guess I need to understand what Section 7 does. Am I first correct that 7 and 9 are specific special levies? And this just allows you to make a calculation appropriately.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogrebnoy, that's correct.
Okay, and then so Section 7 may be the same thing, but I, in reading the language, it's just a little less obvious.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogrebnoy, Section 7 is more broad. It's written in very broad language. The intent of Section 7 is, again, with the levy limit calculations, pretty much the last step is we take a levy base aid and we inflate it for inflation, and the last step is to subtract the aids you're going to receive next year. Again, if the aids go down, your limit goes up. If the aids go up, your limit goes down. That's supposed to kind of automatically. In the unallotment scenario, the question becomes, what aids do you subtract? The aids that we told you you were going to get back in August before we knew the unallotments, or should the subtraction incorporate the unallotments? And again, looking for a number of reasons, we think the legislative intent was that when there are unallotments, a local unit should have to Not that they should have to, but when there are unallotments, a local unit can recoup the revenue they lost through special levies. Could have been done another way, but we think that's what the legislative intent was. We think everything is covered.
This is just trying to say
we're not going to do it the other way. We're not going to do it in the subtraction.
Where's the legislative intent that they can levy it back? What statute or reference are you referring to?
Pretty much the ones that we are amending here in Section 6. If you go to page 36, the changes on 36.23 and 36.25, those have to do with levying back for emergency debt certificates that they might issue to cover their cash flow due to unallotments.
Yeah, no, I get 6 and 9. I think they're very specific. I'm just, what is the broader language? Where are you gathering legislative intent to want to do Section 7? That's what I'm trying to get at.
And Section 7, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamilla, Section 7. The purpose of Section 7 is to say you can't do both. So whenever there's an allotment, we are not going to change the subtraction. That's the point. Section 7 is the flip side of Section 6 and 9. The special levies are provided. Here they are. And Section 7 says you can't also, or we're not going to administer it so that you can also argue that we should change the subtraction and give it to you.
Okay, so does
it's
section...
not a matter of giving it to them, but it's a matter of doing it twice.
Mr. Chairman, so does Section 7 only refer oppositely to 7 and 9, Section 7 and 9, or is it
six
affect...
And
six.
6 and 9, or does it affect other situations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, the language in Section 7, I would argue, is limited to unallotments. When there's an unallotment, if any aid payment or other amount is reduced by unallotment, what this is saying is the Department of Revenue is not going to change that amount for purposes of this subtraction that I've been talking about, such that the levy limit would automatically go up. Instead, and it doesn't say this.
Is that all levies or just the ones referred, Mr. Chairman? Is that just referred to in the other two sections? Or is this all levies now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamiller, the overall levy limit limits a local jurisdiction's property tax levy except for special levies. So the question becomes, when there's an allotment, do you adjust both? Do you adjust one, the other? And again, we think legislative intent was when there's an allotment and the local unit is not going to receive the revenue in the next year that it thought it was going to, how can it recoup that revenue given that we have levy limits? There's a number of choices of how this could be done. And this provision, the intent of this provision is to say for the purposes of your levy limit calculation, that's not going to change for unallotments. What is going to change for unallotments is you have these authorities by which you can recoup 100% of the same amounts. So this is saying that any levy governed by your levy limit is not going to increase for unallotments. What can change are your special levies, and there are three, I think, special levies.
Okay. That,
yeah. Mr. Carlson, you want to speak to this?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And frankly, Section 7 is one of the more absurd results, in my opinion, of what happened due to the unallotments with levy limits. If I could refer you back to Clause 22 of the special levies starting on lines 39-10, you put this provision into effect last session basically to allow the cities and counties to have levy authority for the unallotment of 2008 local government aid and county program aid cuts that were made on December 25th. There was no way under the existing law for the cities and counties subject to levy limits to levy for those cuts at that time. Okay, then we had the situation where there was, following the conclusion of the 2009 session, additional unallotments announced formally for 2009 and tentatively or preliminarily for 2010. The whole intent of the preliminary announcement of the 2010 unallotments, which were not formalized until February 4th, was basically to frustrate cities and counties' authority to again exercise that special levy. So that we could not make property taxes higher than they might have otherwise been. But what it's really resulted in is, in my opinion, an absurd result that a reduction in aids that's enacted by you is reflected in the basic levy limit, and that increase in authority that happens due to reductions enacted by the legislature occurs in the levy increase or levy limit increase occurs in the same year that the aid cut occurs. but if it's due to unallotment under this language, which to give the department as due was requested specifically by the cities, says that authority will be enacted in the following year. So, for example, to use counties as the example, the $67 million of county program aid cut that is occurring this year in 2010, we will get levy authority if we choose to exercise the special levy in 2011, a year after the cut occurs. If you had enacted that, we would have gotten that authority in 2010. Now, the situation that we face right now under the governor's proposal is we will get the $67 million of special levy authority for the 2010 cut. If you were to carry over the $125 million, which the governor proposes permanently into 2011, then we would get an additional levy authority of that $125 million. So we would have $191 million of levy authority for really 2 years' worth of cuts culminating in 2011. That authority is never going to be exercised. The political and economic environment is such that it's just not going to happen. But I would urge you to make sense of this and say a cut is a cut is a cut. It doesn't matter whether it's an unallotment or a reduction enacted by you. It should be incorporated into the basic levy limit calculation, and the special levy for unallotment should only be for situations where the cut occurs after levies have been certified.
Thank you, Mr. Cross.
Mr.
Chairman. Senator Pugma.
So that was testimony in opposition to Section 7. Correct?
What?
Ms. Consul, I'm trying to get the direction of this correct.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I think Keith might want to comment on that.
Well, I thought I heard him say that it was language the cities asked for.
Mr. Chairman, the cities did ask for this. And again, I give the department its due for doing this. But now that they find themselves in this situation where 2011, they'll have the authority if they want to claim the special levy for the roughly $100 million of LGA cuts that they are suffering this year under the unallotment. And then in addition, under the regular levy limit, for whatever you decide on the certification, if you choose to reduce 2011 local government aid, they could exercise that authority. I'll suggest to you that they're going to be in exactly this situation that I suggest in counties. They'll never exercise that full authority. And this device to delay the authority for the unallotment just isn't going to work. I'll just mention one other thing. If perchance the legislature ultimately does not come up with a budget agreement with the governor and he chooses again to exercise his unallotment authority, if that remains intact for 2011, which right now wouldn't be possible since it's in the next biennium, but say we're talking about the second year, you couldn't levy for that cut because it's an unallotment rather than a legislated reduction. You would have to wait to the following year. Again, I think that's an absurd result. A cut is a cut is a cut. You should get levy authority in the year that the cut occurs.
Senator Pogemiller.
So is that testimony for 40.9 to 44.14, or is that testimony against that language?
But that's testimony against that language.
That's what I thought.
Senator Pogemiller, I think it's more frustration than... Does the League want to comment on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to first be clear that we didn't request this exact language. We requested last year when the unallotments were being effectuated that the 2010 unallotments be done after a time, well, to preserve the ability to levy for that in 2011. Now, this is very complicated, but to step back in history, in December of 2008, we had an unallotment of $66 million of city aid. That was after we had certified our levies. We could not levy for that until, am I getting the dates right? 2009? December of 2008, correct. We couldn't levy for that until we certified our levies the next year for payment in 2010. We also had the governor's unallotment last July of $64 million of city aid. That was levy authority that we could special levy in 2010 as well. Under the strict construct of the statute, we would have also had to have levied if we wanted to recover the 2010 unallotments in the same year. So we would have had three levy special levy authorities all in 1 year. And the concern that we heard from cities was, we can't raise levies that much all in 1 year. It's ridiculous. And we saw that borne out by the actual certified levies that were announced by cities. By doing this the way that the governor administered the unallotments, it did preserve the authority for cities to special levy for the 10 cuts in pay 2011. Again, though, we did not request this specific language. I think one clarification, if I'm not mistaken, for Mr. Carlson's testimony is that if the unallotment does occur and is announced before September 1st, as is indicated on page 39, subdivision 22, we could levy for this in the following year. We could levy for an unallotment if it's announced before September 1st of a year. We could declare it as a special levy in the next year. It only is in the situation where the unallotments occur after September 1st, in which case we couldn't declare a special levy until 1 year hence. So I think that's correct. So we didn't request the language. I don't think we have a problem with the clarification that occurs here. Our support was for how the governor actually administered the unallotments to give us maximum flexibility last year.
So, Mr. Carlson, the legislature gave you more levy back authority than you were willing to execute.
Mr. Chair, members, it was our collective assessment, most of the city representatives that work up here, that the $66 million of unallotment in December of 2008, the $64 million of unallotment in 2009, and the $128 million of unallotment cities experienced in 2010, that would be, I think, a total of $250 million just to special levy those amounts in 1 year. Cities have never had a levy increase anywhere near that amount. We knew from talking to our cities it was not possible and practical, given the economic circumstance, to increase the levy all in 1 year. We urged the governor to delay that 2010 unallotment announcement until February. I think it occurred on February 1st of this year, providing us that authority for next year. This is trying to codify that, I believe. We were only asking for it on a one-time basis. We're neutral as to this language, if I can be clear.
Mr. Nord, do you have anything to add to this?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I oversee the levy limit administration and was involved in a lot of these decisions. It's really a non-issue for last year, because last year the problem that was never foreseen was what happens if an unallotment occurs before we certify aids. Because what we're doing in Section 7 is we're trying to say, if there's an unallotment when you know what the certified aid amount is, do you subtract the unallotted aid or the certified aid before the unallotment? And so it was never envisioned before that there might be an unallotment before an aid is certified. And so, but what happened in 2009 was the governor just announced a preliminary 2010 unallotment and didn't make that unallotment final until this year. So it was a non-issue for last year. But the reason why we're asking for this language is because we need to know going forward, if there was an unallotment in July of 2010, should we administer that unallotment as a special levy, or should we change the aid that we're subtracting when we set the original levy limit? And what we're clarifying here is that essentially all unallotments will be handled as a special levy authority and not as an adjustment to the aid that's used to calculate the initial limit. And that, I think, solves a lot of the timing issues. because if we have to worry about including an unallotment in the aid that we're using to calculate the original limit, then we could be down to the very last minute where we're saying, is that unallotment done or is it not done, and what are we going to be certifying for a levy limit? And so we're just trying to clean it up and say unallotments are special levies, not adjustments to levy limits directly. But either way, whether it's a special levy or whether it's an adjustment to the original limit, they get to levy back for it. And the only timing issue comes into whether it's before or after September 1st. So I don't think we're trying to, we're just trying to clarify how to operate in the future. We're not trying to do anything other than just make things clear. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pokemon.
You said that the governor announced an unallotment, but it actually isn't taking effect till 2010. Could you run through that with me, those dates?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, when the governor made the announcement, I think it was in June of 2009, about how much he intended to unallot for 2009 and 2010, they essentially... The unallotments occurred right away for 2009, but the 2010 amounts were announced as proposed unallotments. So, it was possible that, you know, when the November forecast came out, he might have changed his mind about what he wanted to do for 2010, or it could be that there would be a couple of cities that begged forgiveness on some level. So, you know, things were not absolutely final. In the announcement of January of 2010, an unallotment becomes final when the commissioner of MMB actually goes into the accounts and changes the numbers.
Okay.
And that's what occurred in January or February, right around the end of January this year.
So it has occurred now. Were we notified when that happened?
Yes.
Separately from June?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, my understanding is that there was a separate letter that was sent to you, updating you to let you know that that the proposed number was final, because we've been asking for a copy of that letter to put in our file for when.
Do you have that copy?
I don't know if I have a copy of that yet. I can go check my file, but my understanding is that Commissioner Hansen was going to be sending an updated status letter. In January. I know there was a lot of different letters.
If you don't have it in your file, we probably don't have it in our file.
Senator Pogemiller, I may have it in my file. I just don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, if you do, would you let Senator Bach's office know? Give him a copy?
Certainly.
I don't remember seeing a letter like that.
So, Mr. Nord, the decision has been made on what the unallotment's going to be July 1st. Is that what you're saying?
No, not for what I'm saying, Mr. Chair, is the unallotment that was announced in June of last year for 2010 is final. Any additional unallotments or the budget proposals that I'm not talking about additional unallotments or budget proposals. I'm only talking about the 2010 unallotments that were announced in June of 2009. Those became officially final early this year. And did not change at all from the June announcement.
Yeah.
That concludes that article, I believe. Article 5.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson, an attorney with the department. I'll go through Article 5. Section 1 amends the blanket abatement of late payment penalties as it relates to persons, taxpayers affected by natural disasters. Currently, that exemption or that abatement applies to persons in a presidentially declared disaster area, and the change will be to expand that to include persons in presidentially declared states of emergency and governor declared disasters. The only difference in the designations really is the scope of the disaster as it affects state, local, and national economies. As it affects individual taxpayers, a flood is a flood. Section 2 amends Job Z waiver of repayment statute Failed Job Z businesses are required to repay 2 years' worth of tax benefits. They can ask the Commissioner of Revenue for a waiver. However, there's no time limit for them to ask for that waiver. And what this change would do would be to say that the taxpayers have up to 60 days after a bill goes out from the county or 60 days after a notice assessing those taxes is sent by the Commissioner of Revenue. That coincides with the general appeal of tax orders that taxpayers have for other assessments. And the third change is the Job Z businesses are required to file 2 annual statements to the Department of Revenue, one October 15th, which is a statement of how much tax benefits the businesses received in the prior year, and another one on December 1st, which is an annual certification that the business is in compliance with its Job Z obligations. And what this proposal would do would be to consolidate those two dates to October 15th, which we think will be easier for taxpayers, the deed, the Department of Revenue, and the state and local property tax and economic development administrators to handle. And that's the article and the bill.
Questions, member? Thank you. We'll lay Senate File 2696 over for some action. I'm not sure if this will be some vehicle with the House for the omnibus bill. We'll have to have a discussion with them about whether these bills are going to go separately or part of a larger bill. Tax expenditures. Maybe before, while Dr. Wilson's coming up, I was a little disappointed when I saw Representative Lencheski's local government aid proposal yesterday that she, when she came out and proposed cutting $115 million of local aid.
115.
And I was a little disappointed until I read this morning's newspaper, and I became less disappointed. Local governments. There's a interesting story on the front page of the St. Paul paper above the fold about a seatbelt sting up very close to where I live up in Maplewood. Apparently, the Maplewood police had 2 undercover officers on the intersection of McKnight and Highway 36. Undercover is homeless people. And the intent was to be able to observe drivers when they came up to the intersection and see if they had their seatbelt on. And after 3 hours of them posed undercover as homeless people, people had been then, once they were observed by the undercover police officer, were pulled over on the ramp, and they issued over 100 citations for mostly for seatbelt violations.
How much money did they get from panhandling?
And what's interesting is they had it. Apparently, the city of Maplewood, the city of North St. Paul, and Ramsey County all participated in this on a Sunday, with officers on overtime. It is perplexing to me that cities have enough resources that they can conduct these kind of operations. I got to tell you, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. And I know when Senator Tomasoni reads this, he's going to be even more disappointed because there was a lot of talk about the seatbelt law and how was it going to get used by law enforcement when it became a primary offense. I asked Mr. Paulson this morning to get me the number of the amount of state aid that goes to Ramsey County, because I just kind of briefly looked at market value credit and county program aid, and it looked like about $27 million a year. And what's troubling to me is, you know, we're making tough decisions around here. We're going to cut aid. The governor's proposing to cut aid to nursing homes, cut reimbursements to nursing homes. We're probably going to delay additional payments to schools. But then we're paying money out to cities and counties to conduct these kind of operations while we're cutting a whole lot of important things back in our communities. And
you know, if local governments want to use their property tax money to do these kind of sting operations, have at it. They can be accountable to their voters. But depending on state aid to pay for those kind of operations when we're cutting all kinds of important things around here is pretty troubling to me. And somebody in Maplewood or Ramsey County or North St. Paul needs to come and explain it to me, because there has to be more. And I'm always a little reluctant when I read stuff in the newspaper, but there must be more to the story, because what I read is pretty troubling. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't like the bill, as you know. I argued against it, but I am going to say that often those types of sting operations, if you will, if you call it that, are often not property tax funded but grant funded. They pay for the overtime for officers to do that, and they come from federal grants or state grants. So I wouldn't be surprised if the missing information for your concern today isn't that it's not property tax dollars that go for that, but a separate source of funding. But I'd be very interested in the answer to the specific question on that particular operation.
Mr. Chairman.
It looks like Ramsey County in 2009 received $23.9 million from the state. North St. Paul received a little over $2 million. Yeah, I just question whether that's a good use of state resources. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, if you do have a conversation with the local police department there, you might want to ask them what the motivation was for putting so much investment into that type of a traffic enforcement. And the one thing that comes to my mind is Senator Foley's attempt to limit administrative fines. Administrative fines would be some critics might extrapolate and say that that's a way for local cities to raise money, because the fines go to the city as opposed to the state. And I've noticed in traveling just the suburban area where there's a whole lot more local police officers that are sitting on U.S. freeways that go through the Twin Cities with very extravagant speed traps established. It happens. And just that, so no one knows that I'm not picking on everybody else, my city is one that does quite a bit of it. And on freeways that commonly are a little over the speed limit, it's just the traffic flow that's going on. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. And one kind of has to ask that question, what is the real motive? And so I don't know if that's the motive in this case, but it certainly is worth the question. Because Senator Foley and I both warned of that when we had that discussion just last year, was it, or the year before, and we were fearful that that might occur.
Well, I noticed, Senator Limmer, that in the article, at least, our state highway patrols participated in the sting operation.
Mr. Chairman, does the I didn't see the article. It's alarming, but does it say that they, you know, what did they net out of this? Does it give us a dollar figure? I mean, have we also come to the point where we're putting our cities in the position of having to have bake sales or seatbelt stings? You know, what are we doing? I'm not arguing with what you're saying. I'm shocked about it too, but I have a feeling that
it says most of the tickets were for seat belts, some were for child restraints, but predominantly seat belts. And what it said is there were 103 citations. I think they said the seat belt violation is $108. But I think where the money went, I think the article, the deputy police chief said that the city didn't get any of the money, but I'm not sure the deputy police chief knows. And maybe there were apparently tickets written by multiple jurisdictions, some by the city, some by the county, some by the highway patrol, depending on which car. They had them, according to the article, violators were stacked up 10 deep on the off-ramp for their citations. So they were written by multiple jurisdictions, apparently. So that may change where the money went. But you wonder why the public gets a little cynical about the idea of us raising taxes. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That it raises such a good line of inquiry. I wonder if we wouldn't want to have some joint hearing where we actually sat down with the Crime Policy Committee or the Judiciary Committee to say, okay, what are the sources of revenues that do come back to our cities based on our laws, and how should that be factored in or considered, or what's the relationship with the LGA that we provide? Because we hear that all the time, that if we cut LGA, we're cutting police officers, and, you know, I'd like to see that relation, too, and see what other revenues they do have.
There might be potential offsets that we haven't even dreamt about. It's a pretty interesting story. And Ruben Rosario says, email me and tell me what you think about my column. I'll bet he's, and he said he'll likely run them in Sunday's paper. I'll bet he'll get some feedback. Dr. Wilson, welcome. Tax expenditures. Members, this is pretty serious stuff. I know the Finance Committee would like us to take a look at tax expenditures as a way to help balance the $1.2 billion deficit. So let's listen intently to Dr. Wilson and see if there's anything in here that was put in law once upon a time that it might make sense for us to revisit. I believe, Dr. Wilson, would I be accurate saying that all of these activities would be taxed if they weren't specifically exempted in law? Would that be accurate?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Wilson from the Tax Research Division, Minnesota Department of Revenue. That's not true in all cases. Services are not taxable unless they're specifically mentioned as being taxable. So, okay. Some of the exemptions, in fact, would have to be put into law. Federal conformity also conforms to some income tax provisions that you would have to put an addition in to tax them rather than taking a subtraction out. Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the tax expenditure report. This is the 12th annual tax expenditure report mandated by the 1983 legislature. Bills that were in the House, sponsored by Paul Ogren, and in the Senate by Eric Petty. The first tax was created in 1985, 10 years after the first federal tax expenditure budget became officially part of the federal budget. We were the 10th state to institute a tax expenditure budget. They are due in February 1st of even-numbered years. And it's a major project. It includes estimates of almost 300 separate items. 12 analysts have worked on this part-time, one intern full-time, and most work is done in the summer and the fall, a bit earlier than release of the report. I would say that this study is directed, has been, since all 25 years' worth, all 12 studies have been directed by Carolyn Carlson, a former member of Senate Research who staffed this tax committee in the past. So. Due to her leadership, the quality has been maintained through time.
So, Dr. Wilson, what does it cost to develop this report?
The cost is stated in the letter in the front. I believe it's $130,000.
Okay, I got it.
That's actually a little higher than the past because we couldn't hire cheap labor interns. We only had one intern instead of two, and so we used more expensive labor. So it actually raises the cost, but. Budget cuts sometimes raise at least the listed cost of the study. I wanted to do sort of an overview of the report, point out a few things, almost so I could sort of point out some things for you to look at. And then I want to answer three specific questions about the numbers in the report that have been asked. How do we define a tax expenditure? How do we decide what to put in this report and what not to put in? Why don't we put a total dollars number in? We keep getting asked, what's the total number of tax expenditures? Why don't you add them all up? Why don't we do that? And finally, how do tax expenditure estimates differ from revenue estimates? You are often shocked when you get a revenue estimate that differs so much from a tax expenditure. So I think in terms of using this document, those questions are good questions to ask. Before that, let me just say a word about the concept of tax expenditures. Minnesota taxes income and Minnesota taxes sales, but we don't tax all income. We don't tax all sales. We have many exceptions, and those many exceptions to a broad tax base are like expenditures in two ways. First, they have a purpose, and second, they have a cost. For example, the mortgage interest deduction is an exception to a broad-based income tax. The purpose, presumably, is to increase home ownership, and the cost could be described in two ways. First, at current income tax rates, That deduction will reduce tax revenue by about $418 million in fiscal year 2011. And that foregone revenue, $418 million, is listed in the tax expenditure budget as the cost of that item. Another way of looking at the cost, though, that may appeal to some other people more than that, is to think of the cost as a higher tax rate. You could raise the same revenue with rates, income tax rates, if you didn't have this deduction, with income tax rates that are 0.4% lower. So instead of 5.35% as the lowest rate, it could be 4.95%. Instead of 7.85% as the highest rate, it could be 7.45%. You could cut. So the cost could either be seen as foregone revenue or as a foregone tax rate reduction of 0.4%. Because these exceptions to the base have similarities to direct expenditures, the term tax expenditure is designed as a neutral term for these types of provisions. The statute that requires the tax expenditure budget includes the following statement of purpose. Both direct expenditures and tax expenditures have an effect on the ability of the government to lower tax rates or to increase expenditures. As a result, tax expenditures should receive a regular and comprehensive review by the legislature. And this report gives the information that can assist, at least, in your making that review. You should have a copy of the entire tax expenditure budget in your packet. The copy you have is printed from the online version. We wouldn't normally have some of the stuff on the front page if this were a printed version. But I would call attention to the fact that on the front page there's a box. It says, I'm looking at the second slide basically on page 2 of the handout, but the box in the front of this says, those who use this report should read the introduction. Okay, we're a little worried that because of the links on here, people will skip the introduction. The introduction really explains how numbers are defined, what these things are about, how revenue estimates differ. It provides a lot of information. It's only 4 pages long. So first message is, if you want to use the numbers, read the introduction. Secondly, if you look at the table of contents, you'll see there's a chapter for each tax. And you have a lot of taxes listed. Chapter for each tax. I would point out that there's an introduction to each chapter that provides important information as well. And there's an important distinction for income taxes, corporate and individual. A distinction between passive tax expenditures, ones we basically conform to the feds on. And if you look at the organization of the table of contents, you'll see that those are listed first. We talk about the federal exemptions and the federal deductions first, and then we go to the Minnesota-specific items. And even though we don't show them, as Senator Bach was mentioning, we don't have anything mentioning them specifically in our statutes, if we don't add back something that is subtracted federally, then that is considered a tax expenditure in this study. A final additional comment is, again, we try to make the online version as helpful, as user-friendly as possible. We have links on it. A lot of people just look at the summary table. There's a table that just shows numbers, okay? A lot of people just look at that. I would encourage you not to only rely on that. On the online version, if you click on the number next to one of these, you'll go directly to the description. And the description really does help understand what those numbers mean. It gives it quite a bit of additional information, as we'll see in a second. Turning to the next page, we have an example of an item in the tax expenditure budget. This is chosen somewhat randomly, no particular reason, but the home mortgage interest is one everyone can identify with and understand what it is pretty much. But notice what's included in the report. First, a statutory reference at the top. So if you want to find the statutory definitions, you can find it. Secondly, the first two paragraphs here are an explanation, noting that both a principal and a second residence are qualified for the mortgage interest deduction. Noticing that there's a cap of $1 million on debt, $100,000 if it's not used to improve or purchase. The third paragraph gives some history. When was this adopted? When was it last changed? And below that are the number affected, 733,000 returns. And then at the bottom, the revenue foregone. The information here, in other words, is not just a number, but you can get quite a bit more information about the history and the nature of these. Sometimes those little descriptions are not very clear in the summary table, and people sometimes think something is something different than it is. So make sure to take a look at that as well. I want to address a couple questions. It's a tax expenditure only if 7 conditions are met. We get asked often, why is this in there? Why is that not in there? How do you decide what's in and what's not? The first condition is that it must be a tax that applies statewide. This means that the only local tax we have in the report is local property taxes. So we do have local property taxes. We don't have tax expenditures for any of the other local taxes, which don't apply statewide. And again, it's a judgment call, but that's why some things are not in there. Secondly, it must provide preferential treatment. Now, that's a term that is in the statute that we're supposed to use. It's not necessarily easy to determine. But, for example, we assume the standard deduction and the personal exemptions in the income tax are not preferential. Everybody gets the same exemption, the same standard deduction. So some things like that are not included. You won't find a tax expenditure for the personal exemption. And the only reason is because we don't think that's a preferential item. Third, the item has to have a revenue impact. There are a lot of statutory provisions that are not included in here because even though they're in statute, they're not really in effect. The example given here is the St. Charles Food Processing Plant, which at least when we read the newspapers, it looks like even though there's a sales tax exemption for those construction materials, if it isn't constructed, there's not going to in fact be a cost. And so rather than putting it in, given the new status at this point, we just left it out. There are bioscience zones, there's an international development zone, a bunch of these things that have no revenue impact at this point, even though they are in statute. And rather than putting zeros in, we just have left out those. Number four, it's not subject to an alternative tax. You could say, well, motor vehicles are exempt from the sales tax, the general sales tax, but of course they are subject to the motor vehicle sales tax. Cigarettes are exempt from the sales tax, but they pay an in-lieu sales tax. The same thing is true of solid waste and lottery tickets. So if there's another tax, it's not included. Fifth, it's not counted as a direct expenditure. You will not find the property tax refund in here as a tax expenditure because it's aligned directly in the budget. We don't have to give you that number. You know that number. You see that number. So if it's in the budget as a line item, even though it's tax-related, it's not included. Sixth, the legislature must have authority to impose a tax. So the exemption for taxing federal bond interest, we're not allowed to tax that. You're not allowed to tax. Nobody can. You know, states can't do it. So there's no use to include it, no reason to include what we lose in revenue from that. You have no power to do it. And finally, it's a tax expenditure only if it's included in the definition of the tax base. And this is where there is some controversy, is what do you decide? We're talking about exceptions. Exception to what? Exceptions to the norm of some sort, but who defines the norm? How do you define what is the exception and what's part of the basic tax? For income taxes, we generally follow what the Joint Committee on Taxation at the federal level has done. Basically, income from all sources less expenses that are reasonable and necessary to generate that income. And notice a couple of things it means. It means that accelerated depreciation is a tax expenditure because it is greater than what we think true depreciation would be. So true depreciation is basically the norm against which accelerated depreciation is measured. On page 46, you can find, when you look at accelerated depreciation, you will find the definition of how we measure true depreciation, what do we assume it is. But obviously, that's somewhat of a judgment call. Personally, independent exemptions are not in the base. Graduated rates, we don't assume anything about the rate structure at all. That we're just looking at the base, not the rate structure. And for corporate tax, the tax base is assumed to include equal weight apportionment. So the increased sales apportionment above the one-third is considered a tax expenditure. You'll see an item in there for it. It's also assumed that there would be a throwback rule. So the absence of a throwback rule in Minnesota, you'll see a tax expenditure in for that item as well. For the sales tax, defining what the base is actually more problematic. We don't have any other standard to go by. States differ tremendously in how they define the tax base in their tax expenditure studies. We have, from the beginning, defined the tax base as to include all final purchases of tangible goods and services. This means that business purchases, in many cases, are exempt if they're used in production or if they're purchased for resale. Some states include purchase for resale as a tax exemption in their tax expenditure budget, but we don't include those here. We do include, though, capital equipment as a tax expenditure, the exemption for capital equipment by refund. And we include a lot of business services in the base as well, so not taxing legal services, for example, purchases by businesses is considered to be tax exemption, and you'll see the numbers in here. Note that the sales tax is not defined to be a consumption tax. I think most economists who look at the sales tax think it should be a consumption tax, but capital equipment exemption is considered these purchases by business, in other words, many economists would say you shouldn't be taxing the business purchases at all and would prefer you use a consumption tax as the base and only look at exemptions for consumers. But notice it's a broader definition than that. All final purchases by businesses. The second question I want to address is why don't we report a total? We have been asked by a number of legislators for a total. What is the total tax expenditures for income tax? What is the total for sales tax? What is the total for all taxes? We want to compare them to something and say how much revenue we're losing from these compared to something else. So it's a good question. Why don't we include a total? The first reason is for sales tax, at least, the list is clearly incomplete. If you look at page 108, I point this out partly because there's a change in here that was recommended by your staff that we have done that is different. But page 108, it's actually 107 and 108, but 108 has the numbers on it. These are selected services, exemption of selected services. And you'll notice that we break them up into a lot of different types. For the first time, we break them into business purchases and consumer purchases separately. What we have found is that you are often very interested in how much of this is consumer versus business, and some of your provisions in the past have been written to only include the consumer portion of some of these items. But if you look at this list, you'll notice that as listed here, four-fifths, 80% or so of these are business purchases. So when you expand to services, a lot of your money is going to come from business purchases if you use this list. But the note I want to make now is that the list for consumers in particular is incomplete. It does not include medical services. It does not include educational services. It does not include housing services. It does not include construction labor, for example. We have repair labor, but not construction labor. This is not a complete list. It is selected services. If you try to add up a total, you'd have to have the other ones in as well. And there is a question about how far you go in terms of going out in different directions. So if you add these up, you're going to get a real understatement of what sort of the total could be in that case. The second reason, though, is you can't really add these things up. You can't add them up because there are interactions between tax expenditures. Sometimes when you take two expenditures and if you were to do two things at once, the total cost is going to be less than it shows, a negative interaction. Sometimes it's going to be greater than it shows by just adding the two together, a positive interaction. I've got an example on page 5, top of page 5, itemized deductions, and you've seen this in some tax, or at least the House has seen this in some of their tax bill, last year's tax bill, where there was a huge interaction term added in the revenue estimate. On the left-hand side, the tax expenditures are not additive is the heading. On the left-hand side, you'll see added up the simple sum of the tax expenditures for itemized deductions, 418 for home mortgage interest, 202 for charitable, 184 for real estate, 64 for medical expenses, et cetera, and a little bit more on the others. It adds up to $880 million. But if you were to just get rid of the mortgage, the itemized deductions completely, except for miscellaneous business expenses, which is not included as a tax expenditure, if you got rid of all of these, in other words, at one time, revenue would not go up by 880. It would only go up by 637. Because remember, when you stop itemizing, you get the standard deduction. And once you get to the standard deduction, you can't lose anymore. And so the total loss sort of gets headed off as you get rid of more than one of these. And you get a smaller number, 27.5% or so less than otherwise. There are positive interactions as well, and I just put the second one in here. It's the standard deduction for elderly and blind. Again, this only goes to those who don't itemize right now. And the cost is listed in the study is $15.5 million. But if you didn't have the itemized deductions so that all the elderly got this, in other words, if you'd gotten rid of the itemized deductions as well, the cost would go up to $28.4 million, which is an 87% interaction. So again, just a warning that these interactions can be large, and so adding these things up becomes problematic. There are a lot of other interactions as well for the income tax. If you get rid of a number of things, you start raising people's income. By getting rid of a number of things, you're going to push people into higher tax rates. And as a result, the cost of these things begins going up. There's been a federal study that estimated that for federal, if you get rid of the itemized deductions, don't consider that. For the other items in the federal tax expenditure budget, the cost would be about 16.5% higher than just the simple addition for all the other items because they have a progressive income tax. Now, Minnesota's income tax is not nearly as progressive. I don't think the interactions in Minnesota's case would be more than 4 or 5%, but you do have this interaction if you start doing multiple things to worry about.
Yeah, you kind of did
There are similar interactions in sales tax. I won't use an example given here in introduction and in corporate tax as well. But when you look for a total, I put the chart at the bottom of page 6. If you just sum them up, you get a number. But then you'd have to add, subtract the negative interactions, add positive interactions, and the omissions in the case of sales tax are large. So you end up with a lot of question marks. And basically the message is we don't think we can come up with a total number that makes very much sense. I would say, though, that the interactions in the sales tax are relatively small. I think that the omissions is the big issue in the sales tax rather than that. We do have information. We have been asked how much of consumption is taxed by the sales tax. And if you look at the Bureau of Economic Analysis and you do an analysis of their definition of consumption, our estimate is only 28% of consumption expenditures are taxed by the sales tax, 54% of goods, and 10% of consumer services. So suggests that there is, in fact, a large gap between services that are a lot of services that are not taxed, both on the consumer side as well as the business side.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, thank you for coming, Doctor. I'm one of those people I always want to say, okay, now how much are we spending? And I have a really hard time. I understand what you're saying. It's far more complex than how much are we spending. But maybe it would be helpful to see a comparison and say there are 45 states that charge sales tax on clothing, and Minnesota is only one of five that doesn't. Or Minnesota is one of the only that provides an exemption or a deduction for this or that. And if I know that these get into very minute categories, but if there were some overall comparison, it surely would help us. I think we are going to have to engage in a major overhaul of our tax policy in Minnesota. I don't think we have any choice. And I think that for folks sitting around this table, we better figure out right now what's the best policy going forward and start having that discussion. And maybe that's one of the ways, rather than saying, how much does this all add up to and is that good for the state of Minnesota, maybe we should try and gauge ourselves against some of the other states. And I wonder if you have some of that information that you can provide us.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, there are some of those comparisons, and we can make them available. There is a, on the sales tax, there is a recent study of services that are taxed in all states, which is very good and fairly up to date. On goods, on exemptions for goods, there are is less easily accessible, but I'm sure for something like clothing, it's not hard to find. On the income tax, there's a good study by the state of Wisconsin, like the Legislative Fiscal Bureau in Wisconsin, that at least compares all the income taxes and what deductions they have, at least for the big ones. So there's some evidence there. For example, a lot of states don't actually have an itemized deductions for mortgage interest, and they deal with some of these very differently. And that information could be gotten from there. But we don't have something pulled together. I mean, I think you're right. Looking at what the states does is would provide useful information.
Mr. Chair, it's been my impression that we have been taxing manufacturing, and that's been a hardship for manufacturing, especially when we don't charge any tax on the services industry. And so I don't know that anybody should be surprised that the services industry in our state continues to grow and become a bigger part of our economy, and the manufacturing continues to go down. And I think one of the ways we could start to look at this is say, all right, how out of line are we with other states? It may be more the information that we need as policymakers to say, okay, if we actually are going to encourage more manufacturing in Minnesota, maybe our tax policy has some impact on that, and we can start working on that. I know that I'm not the first to say that or the first to think that here in this committee, but I do think that maybe more quantitative information about what other states are doing and what that impact is in their state's economy would be really helpful for us.
You know, Senator Ortman, we had a discussion in Senator Metzen's committee last week, Senator Scoy and I did, about what are some potential impediments to hiring. And we should see in this economy if we could find a way to remove them. And it was interesting. We were having a conversation about unemployment taxes that employers pay. And Minnesota has a state that's has a lot of reliance on your experience rating of your company. So you pay a higher percentage of your payroll in unemployment taxes if you've had layoffs. And what was interesting to observe was, I believe Mr. Nelson from the department said that about 70% of Minnesota businesses are at a 0.7% of payroll. up to like 20-some thousand in wages, 0.7%. It's about 70% of businesses are there. But that the other businesses have a higher rate, and the maximum rate, the people with most of the seasonal-type employees that do occasional hiring, and that certainly is the case in manufacturing, where their employment is determined by this demand for whatever they're producing, that their payroll tax is over 10%. 10%. So it seems like if we have real stable businesses that don't have a lot of layoffs, we charge them almost nothing for unemployment payroll overhead. But if you're the kind of business that adds and reduces employees, we charge over 10%. As it seems like a real disincentive to get these kind of seasonal employers or employers that might add people, but it's a pretty high hurdle, first dollar of payroll out, to have an unemployment tax at over 10% of payroll when we have the more stable employers paying seven-tenths of 1%. I think there's some work needs to be done there if we want to talk about barriers to people hiring, experience rating relative to unemployment. It seems like maybe we could spread that burden around some more. And Mr. Nelson over at Dean said that Minnesota and Utah really are outliers, that we're heavily dependent on experience rating as it relates to unemployment taxes we assess. And it's they're just, and we don't ever talk about unemployment taxes here, but I think there are some obstacles to hiring that we need to give some consideration to.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Wilson? Senator Robin, the unemployment tax, of course, is not included in the report, so it's ignored in this report as well. In relation to Senator Ortman's comment, our sales tax has sometimes been portrayed as unusually narrow base, and I think that really is misleading. I think you can make a good case for making our base broader, but part of that comes from misuse of some federal data. It turns out federal data, when they talk about our sales tax collections, they don't include our motor vehicle sales tax, but they include it for almost every other state. And so when you compare states, we got 10% of our sales tax collections that's being missed. So it really is hard to interpret. And I think I remember Governor Ventura used to make this comment, we have the second highest rate, and we're ranked 20th or something. And it was based largely on misleading use of that information. But if we tax clothing, for example, we would actually have a broader sales tax base than most states. And in services, we tax about maybe slightly more than average, but just about average on the service side. On income taxes, one of the things that was surprising people when we did the work on reciprocity was that income taxes are higher in Wisconsin than in Minnesota for a lot of people. And people were surprised because Wisconsin has lower tax rates. How can their tax be higher? But of course, it's the base, and they have a broader base than we do. And as a result, they have lower rates, but in fact have higher taxes for depending on the person's situation, but in many situations we'll end up with higher taxes. So I think the comparison to other states is fair, although I would say that most states have narrow sales tax bases. And one final comment. On the business side, I think Minnesota taxes less business purchases than most states. So I think on the business side, our capital equipment exemption is broader than most states have. And in some other areas too, we are actually ahead of other states in terms of ahead. If you're talking about keeping business costs down, we're ahead of in that sense. But of course, that means more expensive tax expenditures in the report.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. But if we could, sir, find some way of I know that when you broaden the base, you can lower the rate when it comes to sales tax generally. I mean, I think we all understand that concept. But it would be nice to know, out of the 50 states, how many tax clothing. And what would be their percentage? And you may have given us this, or, I think the department has been very good about providing the information that we request. But I think we're going to need to look at the balance between our sales tax and our income tax. I, for one, think that we should not be relying on income tax so much. And you can see why with our current revenue shortfalls, it's income tax that we're having a hard time with. And that if we weren't charging as much in income tax, we would actually be generating more in the economy and stimulating the economy. And shifting more to a sales tax would help us long-term economically and with the stability of our tax. So in that sense, if it's available or if you could make it available for us to see what are other states doing on sales tax, we can adjust for the fact and understand that, you know, the tax rates depend on, you know, what else they tax, but it surely would be nice to get a list if you could do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Orman, we'll get some of that information to you.
Thank you.
Senator Shedd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, I think most states that have a sales tax tax clothing. Why would Minnesota's tax and clothing give us a broader base? Is it because of the other things we do, I mean, that are out of the ordinary for other states? Could you, and maybe you said this already, but what is it that we do that's out of the ordinary? Because exempting clothing is out of the ordinary in terms of other states that have a sales tax. That much I know.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I didn't mean to imply that, but I think you're right. It's the fact that, at least on the consumer side, if you look at Minnesota, a lot of states have very narrow bases and don't tax many services at all.
Okay.
So that in 1987 we added some services, and we were ahead, certainly ahead in that move. Some of the states have come along, but we're not unusual on the service side. We're not like South Dakota. We're not like a couple of Washington State. A few states really tax almost everything. We're not like that, but we're not. The point I was making is, I think sometimes people get the impression that our sales tax is extremely narrow base, and I think that the big exception compared to other states is really clothing. I mean, it is true that a lot of states tax auto repair labor, for example. That's another one that's fairly big that differentiates us a bit. On the services side, I think the basic argument is, if you want to expand the sales tax base, you may need to think about going beyond what the typical state does, rather than thinking of the typical state as the goal.
Okay.
Being average may not be the goal if you're looking at trying to get a broader base.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if I might just ask, is the political contribution refund in here? I just didn't find it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, that is included in the budget, in the regular budget, as an expenditure item, so it's not included.
I heard you say that I'm sorry, I missed that.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Wilson, I'm on page 7374, the corporate franchise tax, and we've had a lot of discussion about our rate of 9.8%, but obviously when you look at this list of this equation that's written out here, that isn't the number that's charged. For the individuals, you had a 0.4% reduction that could be applied to everybody. Do you have the same calculation on the corporate franchise tax, kind of the effective rate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Soy, the 0.4% was only related to the mortgage interest deduction. In other words, the mortgage interest deduction would raise enough by itself to allow just that one item to lower the rate by 0.4. If you expand it broader, you could obviously drop the rate a lot more than that. So you'd be talking about specific items. I mean, the way a quick and dirty way to do that, which is pretty much what I did there, is just to take the numbers in here and divide them into collections. Now, collections this year are very low, so it's sort of maybe an unfair collections. If you assume that, if you sort of look at the corporate tax is raising about $1 billion, $900 million, then if you look at the tax expenditures, if it raises, give the percentage it raises, you add that to it, you can sort of get a feel for how much the base could come down.
So if you raise $100 million,
the rate could come down.
If you raise $100 million, you're at a 1%, or did I 10%?
$100 million is a tenth of a billion. Yeah, so it could come down by roughly 10% of the. Basically 1%, because a 9.8 is almost 10%. So it's sort of that's
about 1%.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And again, I do want to, the next slide will address this, but there's a little, these are not really revenue estimates, so we've got to be a little careful in some of these. But it's a good way to start, to get a feel for how large the rate reduction could be, or how large, much higher rate we're paying because of a change in the base.
Thank you. Very good.
Mr. Chair, I'm almost done here, despite the fact that it looks like a lot of slides. Unlike revenue estimates on the top slide, page 7, unlike revenue estimates, tax expenditure estimates, they're different. I mean, these are not the same animals, so don't look at a number and assume that it's going to be your revenue estimate. For a couple reasons, they're different. Revenue estimate will bring in these interactions between items which are not included in tax expenditures. These tax expenditures ignore the impacts on any other tax. For example, if you were to change the motor vehicle registration tax, you will, in fact, have an impact on the income tax because that's an itemized deduction in the income tax. That's included in revenue estimate as an interaction. It's not included anywhere in here. For revenue estimates, effective dates matter a lot. You know that July 1st as an effective date for sales tax means you only get 11 months in the first year. But for some of these items, effective dates, and of course, if you phase something in over 5 years, you're not going to see all the impact. But even more than that, anything that deals with deferral, like depreciation, if you change any of those, you would, in fact, see huge differences in the estimates because the whole concept of tax expenditure is so different from a revenue estimate in terms of taking effect now. This book assumes you've always had this tax in effect, so your accelerated depreciation has been in effect for a while. If you stop it now, you don't get the same kind of an effect immediately. Fourth, this does not take account of collectability. This is, for example, sales tax nexus may be an issue in some of these cases, and we don't do nearly as careful job determining whether this is collectible in the tax expenditure budget as we do in a revenue estimate. That's also true for the federal items. For example, what if you decided you wanted to tax health insurance paid by an employer or veterans benefits? I don't think we could get the information we would need to do that unless the feds did the same thing. So some of these are listed in here, but they may be administratively infeasible. I'm not sure we could actually get the information we need to collect them. And that's particularly true in the income tax when an item doesn't show up on a line anywhere. If we can't get the information, we can't audit. So if it shows up as a line on the income tax return or it's something we get information on a 1099, we can do something. Otherwise, if the feds don't do it, it's very hard for us to get information. This is just for the income tax exemptions in particular front.
So the point of that, Dr. Wilson, is just because there's a number here doesn't
That's
mean the
correct.
Revenue estimate will generate that.
That's right. That's correct.
And my questions on that very subject's on page 105, the de minimis tax exemption.
Yeah.
The $770, the first $770 that somebody buys outside of the state, they do not owe sales or use tax on in Minnesota. But over that, they're supposed to pay it. So the de minimis, if we got rid of the de minimis of $770 and said, you buy anything outside the state of Minnesota, you owe sales tax here when you bring it back into the state. If we got rid of the de minimis, it shows that we should score $10.7 million in 2010. I'm assuming if we had counsel draft up that provision and got rid of that de minimis, it might score less than that.
Mr. Chair,
but it's pretty attractive.
I can assure you that you are correct.
Sure. It's a pretty attractive tax expenditure to take a look at. Any idea how much less? Will it score $1 million even? I mean, what kind of compliance can we expect? Any idea?
The only states that collect much from use tax at all are states that put a use tax line on their income tax return, and even there it's a very small percentage of the total. Use tax enforcement on individual consumers, not from businesses, but on individual consumers, is very tough. And so part of the reason that was put in was because it made people look like they were violating the law when you knew they were going to do it anyway. And by the way, that de minimis exemption creates problems on our estimates too, because, for example, magazine subscriptions. A lot of those would be probably de minimis, exempt under de minimis, and so what do you do with magazine subscriptions if the company doesn't have a nexus in Minnesota, then obviously we're not going to get the money from the company, and as a result, it'd be use tax, but with de minimis, we're probably not going to get it. De minimis really does create some real questions in the estimates as well.
So we shouldn't assume that the sales tax exemption on publications would generate the amount of revenue that's in the tax expenditure either because of the de minimis.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Actually, during the Ventura sales tax reform proposals, the initial estimate that came over from the department was fairly large for publications because that was one of the things he was going to tax. But within a few months, the number dropped considerably when they were pushed a little bit on they. I was on your side. Okay. But anyway, when the department brought a revised estimate out, it dropped considerably because the companies didn't have nexus, and we weren't going to get it from the individuals. So, and it isn't necessarily even the de minimis that causes the problem. It's just the unenforceability of the use tax on consumers.
Well, I mentioned that, members, so that if any of our finance people are watching us, they shouldn't assume because something's in the tax expenditure budget that we actually could collect that much revenue. Dr. Wilson's revenue estimate might be much different than what you see in the tax expenditure report.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I had somebody contact me, I mean, a number of years ago. They had bought one of these little trailers, a small little trailer. I think they bought it, like, in the state of Washington, or they bought it out west someplace, and they came here and found out they had to get a license tab for it. And I don't know if that fits into this, but it was something they were quite shocked about, and that may be where we get some of the money. I don't know if it falls under sales. I mean, I would think it would fall under use tax. I understand it.
Well, I think, Senator Scheid, I think that's right. I think when you buy something and bring it into the state and then have to license it or register it, the sales tax is then due. Dr. Wilson, is that right?
Mr. Chair, that may vary in different situations. Certainly for if you just buy an automobile and bring it straight in, it depends whether you're buying it and bringing it into the state immediately, I think. My guess is, in the case of this trailer, it was a motor vehicle registration tax. It was a registration tax rather than a sales tax that was being that was at issue. That they would have had to pay to put a license on the back of that trailer, and that's probably the tax that they were paying rather than a sales tax. But I could have been sales tax related, but I doubt it.
Well, Dr. Wilson, I actually know somebody that bought a motor, I believe it was an outboard motor in Ontario, brought it back across the border, and they ended up getting a bill from the Department of Revenue for use tax. So somebody over there is tracking those kind of purchases. I was pretty glad to hear that he actually got a bill for it. He's a good friend of mine, but he was pretty surprised when he got it, I can tell you. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I dialed in on without meeting with the constituents, so if I missed something, I apologize. But I think the actual fact of the matter is pretty much anything you buy out of state and bring in, you're supposed to pay the use tax on. It's not just those things that you register or license. Of course, the practical way of keeping track of those things is not there. I couldn't imagine what sort of a regimen or program that would involve. But I've gotten an interesting contact from constituents on both sides of this. One is one of my constituents was pretty cranky because he brought in some collectible art somehow or another. He was discovered and had to pay the tax and was pretty cranky about it, but you know, it is what it is. Another one who diligently and faithfully pays his tax on stuff that he buys from out of state and really wants us to ensure that we're going after everyone who's buying goods in other places, and I just don't know how to solve that problem.
We've been having that
to the extent that it's a problem. Yeah. I mean, I know we have that discussion about internet sales.
Maybe if we talked about this more often on days we were on television, some taxpayers might feel guilty that they're not paying their use tax. Dr. Wilson, anything further to add?
Mr. Chair, the one other comment I'd make is that the last item under this, unlike revenue estimates, tax expenditure estimates, they're based on an old forecast. I mean, this work was done in the summer and the fall, but this study's done every 2 years, so it'll be 2 years. These can become 2 years out of date. This became a real problem with the last study because we did not anticipate the recession. And if you look at these numbers and compare them to the numbers from 2 years ago, you'll see a lot of them, particularly in the sales tax area, have dropped a lot. A lot of that is just the effect of the recession. So because of the timing between them, these estimates, it's not updated with every forecast, so these get old estimates, and that's another reason why you can expect quite a difference if you see economic conditions change. That could be good news, but it could go up instead of down. One final comment. I do want to say that our study has been cited on numerous occasions as one of the better tax expenditure budgets. I have a quote here at the bottom of page 7, the second slide. Oregon, Minnesota, and Connecticut published relatively comprehensive informed reports that could serve as a model for other states. This is a large survey done of tax expenditure budgets of other states that goes into detail about what's included in each and tries to evaluate each of the state's studies. There are 42 states that now have such studies. On the next page, you have a slide of the things that they used as an evaluation. And you'll notice at the bottom there are four things we don't do. And we do not include a rationale for an expansion. We don't say what the purpose is. We don't try to show distribution by income level, except for some work we've done for the House last year. And we do not include evaluation of each expenditure. Some of the tax expenditure budgets actually do that kind of evaluative work as well, but you'll notice very few, only three states, including one that only has an income tax, no sales tax. So it's a little easier if you only have one tax to worry about. I conclude just with the bottom slide on page 8, the purpose of the tax expenditure budget. This is a quote from the statute about tax expenditures receive a regular and comprehensive review by the legislature as to their total costs or effectiveness in achieving objectives, their effect on the fairness and equity, and the public and private costs of administering the tax expenditure finance programs. And my question to you is just, has the report served that purpose? And if not, what changes can be made? If you do look at the graph, charts at the back, as bad as misleading as they can be, the counts of tax expenditures certainly don't show a drop in tax expenditures since we started publishing the report, except for income tax with the Reagan income tax reform, which Minnesota piggybacked on. You'll see the income tax dropped between 87 and 89 a lot, but otherwise we've not seen a drop in numbers, certainly. But and with that, I will conclude.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry I was drawn away for most of your presentation. And maybe these questions were raised, and if they are, you just tell me I already answered that and forget it. But on slide 13, differences between revenue estimates and tax expenditure estimates, has there ever been any attempt or do other states present at any point alternatives that are based on dynamic scoring, or is it just too daunting a task and it's just can't be done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm sure that no states in their tax expenditure budget do that.
Okay.
Dynamic scoring has been done in some states. There is some history of it. Massachusetts, California, Washington State, I believe.
And do they use that to do revenue estimates or fiscal notes on legislative proposals?
In those states, they have.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
They have tried to do that. In California, the model was developed by, I think, people at one of the California universities. I'm not sure which one, but it was a generally clear model, model to do dynamic revenue estimating, and they in fact used that to supplement revenue estimates. They never used the numbers from that to actually score things for budget purposes. The difficulty comes because the models are so complicated that nobody quite trusts them. You have to put your trust entirely in the economists. The people who push for dynamic scoring assume they will get very big numbers, mm-hmm. and they don't tend to get numbers anywhere near as large in those models if you assume the budget has to be balanced. I mean, one of the problems is if you keep spending the same and you cut taxes, you can get a big effect, but you get an unbalanced budget. And so if you assume that you have to change expenditures and taxes together or change the mix of taxes, so if you cut one tax, you raise another. If you cut a tax, you cut expenditures. Once you make that assumption, the dynamic revenue effects are actually fairly small compared to what people expect. And so in states that have used this in the past, most states have discontinued to use completely. The law has not been renewed in a couple of states that had the law that had a sunset date on it, and they never renewed it. And so most of those models have not been in use. It's not to say that there aren't dynamic impacts and that it's impossible to model them, but the cost of those models far exceeded what the usefulness of them ended up being in the states that have done it. I do have a memo, I think, that I could share with you on dynamic revenue estimating that sort of summarizes some of the state experience with them, how large the effects were shown in some of the states that were doing it. I mean, you may get a 10% or a 20% effect in some cases, so that the cost is actually 10 or 20% lower in the long run, but usually long run means at least 5 and usually 10 years later. So it doesn't come immediately. And so in terms of budgeting, it doesn't really change your numbers much in the budget period that you've got to balance the budget in. But you do see the effects longer term.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Wilson, we do get very interested in that because I think most of us do believe that some changes in tax policy, for example, have an impact on people's behavior. And, I mean, it's just common sense. And we, as far as I know, when we talk about raising cigarette taxes or tobacco taxes, we always get the supply and demand, and all of a sudden they say, well, the amount of revenue that's going to come in assumes that some people will fall off or they will not, or that they will not smoke. And it's and we see those kind of grids for tobacco. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it'd be interesting to us when, quite frankly, when we consider gambling proposals, what happens there, and rather than just looking at estimates from Oregon or something, okay. What happens with behavior here in Minnesota, and yet we dealing with that is precluded, although we do it in. I think we've done it when people come in with cigarette tax hike proposals. We say, well, we're diminishing returns because people are going to quit. And then we say, but the health care costs are going to go down. So it's a, you know, it balances out or something in terms of cost to the state. And that becomes the chatter, even if it's not in the in the estimates.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, we certainly show behavior. We make assumptions about behavioral change for cigarettes in our revenue estimates. And the reason we do it there, and the reason why we don't do it, is we will look at behavioral change anytime where it's believed to be fairly substantial, but also where we have some literature to depend upon. In terms of
Mr. Chairman, that deals with price points.
States all over have changed cigarette taxes. There are all kinds of studies about the elasticity of demand for cigarettes. So we can come up with, and we have our own experience of price increases, so that we know pretty much what response we can expect to an increase in cigarette taxes. We also do this for alcohol taxes. The difference is that for cigarettes, the tax is an extremely large percentage of the price. Whereas for alcohol, it's a very small percentage of the price. So the responsiveness in alcohol shows up to be almost nothing because the tax changes are very small relative to the total price. We don't change it enough to make much difference. But we do take them into account there. There are other places where there is good data. And where there's good data, we would try to take into account. Capital gains is one where at the federal level we have some pretty good feel. And Tom Stinson, Dr. Stinson, when he does the forecast, he takes into account expected changes in capital gains when federal law changes. So that's one where there is the difficulty there is that state taxes may not have nearly the same effect, but that's a case where there is enough evidence. And I think we suggested that the impact there might reduce the cost of a change in capital gains by roughly 10%, maybe. And so there are times where we will take that into account, but we have to have something to go on more than our hunch. And we don't the other thing I would say is that there are models to do dynamic revenue estimating. There's one model that is used in use in the state. It's called the REMI model. Deed has that model. We used to have it, but with budget cuts many years ago, we discontinued it. It's a very complicated model. We find for tax purposes it's not as useful as we would like. But it was used, and in fact, there was I know it was cited in a study. Someone did, Deed, I think, did some work on the angel investment credit using that model. All I will say is that I think you've got to be really careful how you use the models, and it's the assumptions that drive everything. And if you make all your assumptions to make something look really good, you can make your model will spit out good results. You've got to really question whether the assumptions are correct going into the model. So even when you see dynamic revenue estimates, unless you really trust the person doing them and trust the model, I mean, you're going to push back against it, and it's not going to have that much impact. So.
Dr. Wilson, wouldn't a more dynamic scoring be relatively easy to do on a bonding bill, for example? I mean, if $100 million of construction spending – costs $8 million a year for debt service. I mean, how much income tax and sales tax would $100 million of construction spending create? Would it be more than enough to pay the debt service? But we don't score the additional income tax. Where if we didn't do the bonding, the income tax and the sales tax on the construction material would never develop. Wouldn't that be a relatively easy place to more to do dynamic scoring?
Mr. Chair, I think you could make a case for that. However, remember that we don't do dynamic scoring on any expenditures. I mean, if you talk about starting to do dynamic scoring on taxes, you'd want to do them on expenditures, too. When you spend more in schools, that may also have some development effect. That may have some. I mean, in other words, we often focus on dynamic revenue spending only on the tax side, but you've got the same thing going on the expenditure side. And so if you start doing it on one side, you almost have to do it on the other side as well. In terms of the bonding, I think you do have the difference there, of course, is that with bonding, you're borrowing the money and you're just paying the interest. But, of course, you're paying that over many years. And so if you look at the if you were to look long term at that, you are going to pay that back with interest. Right. So you might, in fact, look at the jobs over the long term. You might, in fact, find a net loss in jobs over the whole period of time, depending on, you know, you get jobs out front, but then you got to raise taxes to pay the bonding or something down the road. Right. It's unclear how you would score it. I certainly wouldn't try that. You might talk to Dee. They seem to like to score these things. So.
Dr. Wilson, anything further?
Mr. Chair, no. I think I would say that when this bill, when in 1983, when this was passed, there was a there was a previous bill introduced in the House, at least before the year where this to create a tax expenditure budget, and it was much more ambitious in terms of trying to make sure that not only do you get the information, but that it actually gets used, and it. It has. It would have done what some other states are doing, which is it was proposing to. It would have required a sunset of existing tax expenditures with them being renewed, et cetera. Some states also have set up ways to do evaluation of tax expenditures. It's hard to do evaluation of 300 items by anybody. Iowa has taken an approach of doing a careful study of a few a year. Then, of course, who decides? I just know that my office probably is not the one to do an evaluation of the effectiveness of Job Z. But there is a question about who should do that work. The House of Representatives last year did put out a publication, a review of sector tax expenditures, and they actually put in here, they tried to do an evaluation from the literature of how effective tax expenditures were. But there is that whole question. I mean, the report doesn't, in fact, include that kind of work, which is what some of what you're looking for. Very few states try to do that there, but where's the right way to do it? You can't do it for all of them. You'd have to choose somehow some limited number to work on or some group. And again, there's no sense evaluating things that we couldn't administratively do so as well. But if you think of the tax expenditure budget as part of the larger process, the question is what is the larger process? How does it? What role does this play in the larger process rather than just thinking of it as a report that comes out as information every 2 years?
Any other questions, members? Dr. Wilson, very nice job.
Thank you.
Very helpful. Well, exactly what we're going to do with it, but it's sure a lot of good information. Members, we're going to meet next week on Wednesday. We're going to have a joint meeting with the Finance Committee. The budget forecast is coming out Tuesday. Wednesday morning, we'll be in this room with the Finance Committee with Dr. Stinson and Commissioner Hansen, Wednesday at 8:30. Until then, this committee is adjourned.